Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. This is Cale Clark, and this is The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio mobile app. Thanks for joining me today for our latest installment of our mini-series, Old Covenant Controversies. And today we're going to talk about a big one, God and violence in the Old Testament. It's such a stumbling block to so many, this idea that God might be a moral monster. And I've talked about the eminent Old Testament scholar, Tremper Longman III. He wrote a book called Confronting Old Testament Controversies. It's really informed my thinking in this series. And hey, I try to read all this stuff so that you don't have to, although you should, if you have the time. But so many of you, we all live such busy lives in this day and age. And at Relevant Radio, I try to break it down for you so that we can get formed as efficiently as we can. And in the book, he talked about how when he was starting off as a scholar, he was really interested in this theme of God as a divine warrior. It just permeates scripture in the Old and the New Testament. But really, nobody else was talking about this. When he was doing his research, he engaged with a couple of Mennonite scholars. To them, it was of great import because, obviously, traditionally, Mennonites are pacifists, so they really wanted to get the theology of this and try to make sense of this. But nobody else is really talking about this idea of God as a warrior, God in violence, until one very fateful day that changed all of our lives, September the 11th, 2001. After the events of 9/11, everyone was talking about God and violence. And not just in terms of what the Quran might say and how Muslims were interpreting it and how terrorists were using it to justify their actions, but people started to look at the Old Covenant scriptures of Jews and Christians and say, hang on here. This God seems to be a pretty violent God. How do we deal with these passages? And some have even used it as a pretext. Atheists like Richard Dawkins saying that that's exactly what God is, a moral monster. We cannot believe in this God. So how can we talk about this as Catholic Christians? Well, we're going to look at some of the arguments that people try to use against the faith based on these Old Testament passages dealing with violence, but we're also try to present, and we're not going to shy away from these things, we're going to talk about them, but we're also going to maybe talk about a different way to look at them, a different lens through which to view them. And one of the ways that we can look at this is that in the Old Testament, as Longman says, God is always described as a warrior, a divine warrior. So we're going to look at some of these passages that deal with God as the divine warrior and just kind of break down some of the more violent bits of the Old Testament for you. You know what these passages are just as well as I do. But if we're properly understanding them in the light of salvation history, we shouldn't be embarrassed by them, and it doesn't conflict with the God of Jesus Christ. All throughout Christian history, there have been those who've said that. Some even broke away as heretics and started their own little sects and groups based on this idea that the Old Testament God is not the same God as the God of Jesus Christ. Can't be. The God of Jesus Christ is a God of love and mercy, not this violent, capricious God that we see in the Old Testament. People like Marcion, who was one of the most famous heretics of all time, I'll tell you about him later, he did exactly that. Well, no. This is the same God. God is always the same, yesterday, today, and forever. Just as Jesus Christ is, so is God the Father, God the Holy Spirit. And so, let's break down some of these violent passages in the Old Testament. Obviously, the first one that comes to mind is the flood, the deluge that destroyed the antediluvian world in Genesis chapter 6, 7, 8, and 9. We looked at this in quite some depth during the Genesis series on The Faith Explained, but it's much different from what you might see in children's Bibles. My daughter, when she got her first as a toddler, her first children's Bible, has all these happy depictions of Noah and the ark and all these fuzzy and friendly looking animals getting on board. It just sounds like a lot of fun, but that is not the picture that's depicted in the actual Bible. Okay, when we look at the flood, this is death. This is devastation. God wipes from the face of the earth the human race he has created, except for Noah, his family, and all the animals on the ark. And it's interesting, my wife growing up, she had a different kind of children's Bible that had very realistic depictions, very lifelike illustrations of people drowning in the waters of the flood and just agony. And just, it was actually pretty disturbing. I'm not sure you want to show this to children, but that was certainly more along the lines of what the book of Genesis is trying to get across here. So there was, of course, the flood. And then in the book of Exodus, we have the plagues of Exodus, the 10 plagues that God sends on the Egyptians in an effort to get Pharaoh to let his people go. And obviously the most devastating one of all is the death of the firstborn, including Pharaoh's own son. The final plague that finally breaks through his hard heart, and he lets the people go. However, he changes his mind. And he thinks he's going to chase down the Israelites at the Red Sea. They've got their backs to the water. They are trapped. But actually, God is leading Pharaoh into a trap. He's got him right where he wants him. And he's going to teach the Israelites this great lesson of faith. But Pharaoh, his armies, his chariots are destroyed in the waters of the Red Sea as the Israelites pass through as if on dry ground. And what happens right after this? And following our Old Covenant Controversy series, we're going to go back to the book of Exodus. We'll look at this. This is the famous Song by the Sea that is really composed by Moses, his sister Miriam. And this is the first time specifically that God is mentioned as a warrior, the divine warrior. But it won't be the last. We see in Exodus chapter 15, in this great song, the Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has hurled into the sea. The best of Pharaoh's officers are drowned in the Red Sea. The deep waters have covered them. They sank to the depths like a stone. Your right hand, Lord, was majestic in power. Your right hand, Lord, shattered the enemy. So that's the first time specifically God is mentioned as a warrior. But again, it won't be the last. When it comes to violence in the Old Testament, obviously another section of the Old Testament that really troubles people is the conquest of the Holy Land. And we did look at some evidence outside of the Bible for the Exodus and the conquest in previous episodes in the series Old Covenant Controversies. I'm your host, Cale Clark. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. But when it comes to divine violence, the conquest is really what sticks out in people's minds. God's command to just wipe out certain people groups. Well, in the book of Joshua, in Joshua chapter 5, there's a really striking passage that just before God sends his people into battle against the people of Jericho, they encircle the walls and they march around. What happens? A figure, a very mysterious figure, appears to Joshua, a figure with a sword drawn in his hand. And this is a mighty warrior, and Joshua is a little scared. He's shaking in his sandals. And he asks this figure, "Hey, who are you? Are you for us or for our enemies?" And this incredibly mighty personage responds, "Neither, but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come." Now, Joshua knows what's going on. We say, who is this? But Joshua knows right away. As Tremper Longman says, he immediately falls to the ground and he takes off his sandals. Why? Because the place he is standing on is holy ground. Where have we seen that before? In Exodus chapter 3, the burning bush, when Moses encounters the divine presence of God at the burning bush. So, as Longman says, this is a dead giveaway. Who is this military warrior? It's God himself. He is the divine warrior. And so, obviously, the battle takes place. The Israelites march around for 7 days, the walls of Jericho. And what do they have with them? The Ark of the Covenant, God's very presence, the mercy seat. And then, on the seventh day, the priests blow the trumpets. And really, it's supposed to be this thunderous sound, really mimicking the thunder and lightning of the divine warrior. And the walls tumble down. Now, what happens later on, This is also intriguing. In Joshua chapter 10, Joshua and his army, they're fighting the Canaanites. They got to beat these guys, and they're pursuing them. The Canaanites are on the run, and God extends the day. This is an incredible miracle. Let me read this to you. It says in Joshua chapter 10, the sun stood still, the moon stayed until the nation took vengeance on their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Jashar? The sun stayed in the midst of heaven and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. There has been no day like it before or since when the Lord listened to the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. This is just so intriguing, this idea that God made the sun almost stand still in the sky, extended the day so that they were able to rout them in an even more complete fashion. God sends a hailstorm against the enemies. And it says that more of them died from the hail than were killed by the swords of the Israelites. Joshua 10, verse 11. The Lord was indeed fighting on their behalf. Then later on, we see that Joshua, as he continues to battle against the Canaanites, there's a battle against a bunch of Canaanite kings who kind of band together. And before this happens, God says, "Do not be afraid of them, because by this time tomorrow, I will hand all of them slain over to Israel." Joshua 11, verse 6. And so God does exactly this, gives them into the hand of the Israelite armies. So we see this again and again, this theme of the divine warrior. What about David? Let's skip ahead to the period of the monarchy, David, Solomon, and all the Davidic kings that were to follow. It's intriguing. God doesn't always fight for Israel. This is part of the divine warrior theme. Sometimes he fights against the people of God. Say, why would he want to do that? Because when they are unfaithful to him, when they fall into sin, they actually become enemies of God. And sometimes God fights against his own people. Look at that in just a second. But when David was fighting against the Philistines in the Valley of Rephaim, he asked God, "Should I go into battle or should I not?" And God says, this is really amazing. God says, "Do not go straight up, but circle around behind them." That's the Philistine army. "And attack them in front of the poplar trees. As soon as you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the poplar trees, move quickly, because that will mean the Lord has gone out in front of you to strike the Philistine army." This is in 2 Samuel chapter 5. Verses 23 and 24. So, hey, when you hear marching in the tops of the trees, that's when you need to go. What's the sound of marching? Well, it's God's heavenly host, his army of angels that are going to fight for and with Israel. Oh, talk about air support. My goodness. There you have it. But again, not all the kings were faithful, and sometimes God actually fought against the Israelites. Here's one place where he was actually fighting with the prophets, not necessarily for the rulers. In 2 Kings chapter 6, the king of Aram, he's kind of flustered. Israel's anticipating every military movie. He's like, there's got to be a spy. There's got to be a mole in my administration, because how do the Israelites know our every move before they happen? He eventually figures it out. It's actually the prophet Elisha, the successor of the prophet Elijah. So Elisha is actually telling the king of Israel, this is what he's going to do next, and this is what he's going to do after that. He's kind of like laying out the battle plan. So the Aramean king is really upset. And so he gets his army together, and he actually marches against the city of Dothan. Now that's where Elisha is living. That's where the other prophets are. And they surround the city. And he wants to take out Elisha, because he's the one who, through God's providence, is passing on this information to the king of Israel. Well, one of Elisha's buddies, another prophet, a servant of the prophet, he's really kind of freaked out. He sees the army coming, and he's like, "Elisha, what are we going to do?" And Elisha says, "You need to calm down." "Well, don't tell me to calm down." In the history of telling people to calm down, by the way, has anybody actually ever calmed down when you told them to? It's never happened with me. But anyways, Elisha says, "Look, you don't understand what's going on here." And he actually prays. He says, "Look, those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And he prays that God will open up the eyes of this servant. And that's what happens. And the servant all of a sudden sees the hills are full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. He couldn't see them before, but they were there. This is the heavenly, divine army of the divine warrior God. And he's going to protect the city. He's going to keep Elisha safe. And sometimes we need that too, don't we? We need our eyes to be open to understand that God is for us. You know, when we are for him, he is absolutely 100% for us. And he's not going to fight against us. He's going to help us in our own battles. And that's good for us to know. It's good for us to know. So as we continue on, we look at the prophets. And we see here a great example in the book of the prophet Jeremiah. How Jeremiah actually says, look, this time the divine warrior is fighting against Israel because they have been unfaithful. It's a prophecy of judgment against the king of Israel. So in Jeremiah chapter 21, there's a king named Zedekiah, and he ruled up until 586 BC when the Babylonians invaded Israel, the exile. It was a terrible time. The temple was destroyed. Jeremiah hides the Ark of the Covenant. And there are two messengers from King Zedekiah that go to the prophet Jeremiah with a request. The Babylonians are attacking Jerusalem, and he wants Jeremiah. Can you please pray to God and intercede and get God to turn back these enemies? Well, this is what Jeremiah says, and he's speaking the words of God. He says, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to pray for the king. In fact, here are some judgment oracles. And this is what he says. He says, you can tell Zedekiah, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I am about to turn against you the weapons of war that are in your hands, which you were using to fight the king of Babylon and the Babylonians. I will gather them inside the city. I myself will fight against you. I'll fight against the Israelites with an outstretched hand and a mighty arm in furious anger and in great wrath. I will strike down those who live in this city, both man and beast, and they will die of a terrible plague. And after that, I will give Zedekiah, the king of Judah, his officials, and the people in the city who survived the plague, who survived the sword and famine, I'll give them into the hands of King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. Whew! He will put them to the sword. He will show them no mercy or pity or compassion. It's incredible. As Longman points out, God is saying through Jeremiah that the king of Israel, this time he's fighting against God himself. God's going to use his outstretched hand and his mighty arm. Where have we seen this before? At the Exodus, at the Red Sea, the plagues that got the Israelites out of Egypt. God is not using his arm to free the Israelites. This time he's fighting against them. Why? Because they have been unfaithful. God is the one doing it. It's not the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, who's so powerful. God is actually granting him this victory. Why would he want to do that? Well, eventually he's going to bring his people back. So we see these examples again and again in the Old Testament of the divine warrior. Maybe the most famous one of all, the most famous account maybe of the divine warrior is in Daniel chapter 7. Daniel has this incredible vision of these beasts that come up out of the sea. Now to the Israelites, the beasts and the sea, they're quite frightening because the sea is really the home of evil. So these beasts come up out of the sea and they're hybrid beasts. They're terrifying to the Israelites. We have one that's a hybrid lion with an eagle's wings, and then it becomes a human person. Very strange, very strange. Then the second one is a bear that's gnawing on three ribs, just trying to have a snack here. Then there's one that has the body of a leopard with four heads, four wings like a bird. They are fast. Okay, so this is really, really terrifying stuff to the Israelites. And then we see these beasts, and then there is someone else. They see one who approaches, one like a son of man, who approaches the Ancient of Days on his throne. He's riding a cloud, coming with the clouds of heaven. It's very interesting. One like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. That's exactly how Jesus describes himself, the Son of Man in the New Testament. And this cloud, that's the peoples around Israel who worship these pagan gods like Baal, the god of the Canaanites. He was thought to be the one who rode the clouds and was in control of storms, lightning, and thunder. No. this is the real Cloud Rider, this God, this Son of Man, this God-man, and it's Jesus Christ. And he defeats these enemies that we see here and sets free the people of God. So when it comes to the divine warrior image, ultimately it finds its fulfillment in Jesus Christ. And ultimately, this is the way to make sense of some of these passages of violence in the Old Testament. In our next episode, we're going to look at how some modern scholars try to explain or maybe explain away the violence in the Old Covenant. Does this make sense? Are we dealing with two different gods, a God of the Old Testament of violence and a God of love and mercy in the New Testament of Jesus Christ? No, it's the same God. And God is always the same in his character. We'll explain this in the next episode of The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. So this is Old Covenant Controversies. I hope you're enjoying the series, but don't go away just yet. We're going to open up our Q&A mailbag right now. Okay, got to answer a question about this guy named Marcion. In our Old Covenant Controversy series, talking about God and violence, we noted that this has been a problem for thinkers throughout the ages. How can we justify the loving and compassionate God of Jesus Christ, the God of mercy, with what seems like a different God in the Old Testament? He's not, but many thought so. One of these persons was Marcion of Sinope. He was a very famous theologian in the early church who basically became a heretic because he couldn't reconcile this. He looked at the Old Testament and he said, this is an angry God. This can't be the God of Jesus Christ. So he was born, by the way, in Sinope in AD 85. This is in modern day Turkey on the coast of the Black Sea. Now, Marcion was actually the son of a bishop. Okay, so how can a bishop have a son? Don't ask. We'll get into that another time. He was really smart. He was really capable. Kevin DeYoung has written an article about this. But he was also really vain. He was very vain. And he had a lot of financial resources as well and a lot of ambition. He came to Rome somewhere between AD 135 and AD 139. And he really got himself into the church and kind of worked his way up the ranks. He gave a huge gift to the church, 200,000 sesterces. Now, how much is that? Apparently, it's more than 100 years' wages. So he had some serious means. But things didn't go so well for Marcion in Rome. He was actually excommunicated because of his views on God, Scripture, the Old Covenant, in the year AD 144. And his gift, his expensive gift, well, it was returned to him, kind of like the 30 pieces of silver. Now, that didn't stop Marcion, though. Just because he got kicked out of the church, he kept spreading his vile ideas wherever he went. In fact, he became kind of a missionary, and he set up these congregations of sorts all over the place that espoused his views on the Bible. Polycarp. Polycarp was a really impressive figure in the early church and a martyr. Polycarp called Marcion the firstborn of Satan. Well, that's what he thought of his teaching. St. Justin Martyr, St. Irenaeus, Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian, Hippolytus, Origen. Everybody condemned the views of Marcion from the East and from the West. Tertullian actually said that when Marcion was kind of forming this anti-church, if you will, his own version of the faith, got a lot of converts. And Tertullian said that he was planting these fake churches just as wasps make nests for themselves, teaching people to deny that God is the maker of all things in heaven and earth, and that the Christ is his son. So basically, what was his main theological teaching that was considered heretical? Well, again, just like so many today, he refused to believe that the God of the Old Testament is the same God of Jesus Christ. He says, I read these passages, God seems so full of divine wrath, I can't accept it. So he actually threw away the entire Old Testament. And he kind of made his own version of the Bible. Basically, he just had Luke's gospel, because he thought, oh, God's very merciful in Luke. So he takes Luke's gospel, bits and pieces from the letters of St. Paul, kind of cut and pasted his own Bible. And he basically made up his own God, that this was an encouraging God, never talked about sin. Forget about God's wrath. Forget about an eternal hell. I don't want to hear about this. This is what God should be like, according to me. It's kind of the gospel according to Marcion. So here's the problem, though. He's like, hey, oof, I like Jesus, but Jesus also talks about an eternal hell. We can't have that. Oh, the book of Revelation talks about the final judgment of God. Well, we got to chuck that too. There really wasn't much left when he was done with the Bible. He called the God of the Old Testament a demiurge, some sort of a lower God, as opposed to the God of Jesus Christ. Well, this sort of attitude really, it's hard to kill, and it's come up again and again and again in the ancient world and in the modern world when people try to explain the violence of the Old Testament and the picture of God as a divine warrior. How are we to understand this in light of the command, thou shalt not kill, which is better translated, thou shalt not murder? How is it that God is commanding these things? Well, in our series, Old Covenant Controversies, we're looking at this. So please check the podcast if you missed an episode, and we'll deal with more on the next one of The Faith Explained. Until then, I'm your host, K.O. Clark. God bless you. Catch you in the next one. Peace.